Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's hard for most of us to understand why wolves should ever be killed. What is happening in Alaska, as we speak, goes way beyond understanding, as the state frames the killing of wolves with the extermination of rats. As we speak, innocent wolves will be shot, snared, and trapped. Why? We pose the question when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Our conversation continues with Dr. Gordon Haber, and now focuses on the current state of the Toklat wolves and wolves throughout Alaska in this special weekly Earth Summit. Let's now make a little diversion here and come back to the Toklat wolves. You know, when I last talked with you in 2005, you had been studying the Toklat wolves, and they had just suffered an enormous loss. Why don't you give some of the history of that and why that was so significant? And then I really want to go and find out what's happened, because that was a dramatic hit. Yeah, I know that your blog is covering the changes since then so effectively. It's a fascinating story.
You're right. They took a big hit in 2005. Actually, they've taken a number of hits over the last 10 years, but that's probably the most serious one so far. That was a very distinct and very, very serious hit. And the reason it was is because in one fell swoop over a couple of months, the alpha pair, both of them were killed. One was trapped, one was shot just outside the park. They were killed, and a couple of pups were killed, and then also a young newcomer female, one of those rare newcomers that was accepted into the group just the year before and had become the primary caregiver to the pups, she was also killed. So the upshot of all of this was that a group of 11 wolves February 2005, this group had 7 or 8 years of experience, the experience of the alpha pair and the other adults. In short order, they were converted to 6 1- and 2-year-olds. Those were the only survivors after all the dust cleared. And let me point out that my research has shown in the past that in this kind of an area where wolves depend heavily on moose and sheep, it usually takes 2 to 3 winters of learning from the adults for these younger wolves to become proficient in hunting those prey animals, in particular, because moose and sheep in different ways are extremely tricky to hunt. It takes a lot of skill and things that the young wolves have to learn. So here we have these six young Toklat wolves, yearlings and two-year-olds, suddenly left on their own. Well, wouldn't you know it, by pure coincidence, that big hit, that conversion of the group from this vibrant group of 11 with 7, 8 years of experience into suddenly just 6 orphans, young orphans, that happened right at the latest peak of abundance of the snowshoe hare cycle. Now, snowshoe hares, Lepus americanus is the scientific name, they have a well-known cycle about every 8 to 11 years. They peak, and these peaks will last a couple of years, and then they come right back down pretty steeply, and then there's a long low until the next peak. Well, as I say, these young wolves were orphaned during that peak, and they were pretty lucky because it's pretty easy to hunt these hares, and they showed a lot of ability to do so, and the hares were so thick that this is one of the highest peaks I've ever seen. You could look down in a willow patch maybe, 100, 200 meters in diameter and easily count, in many cases in 2005, 2006, flying over, you could count 50, 60, 70 hares. So the wolves were able to thrive pretty well the last few years. These young wolves that had not really learned that well how to hunt moose and sheep were able to survive and actually thrive in terms of producing a lot of pups and high survival rates and everything because of the coincidence of this snowshoe hare peak. Well, now the peak is coming down dramatically, as always happens with these snowshoe hare peaks. And there's still significant numbers of hares out there, but there's far, far fewer of them right now as we speak than there was even at the beginning of this winter, and certainly compared to the last 2 winters. Well, of course, I was sure wondering, well, what are these wolves going to do at that point? Will they know how to start hunting moose and sheep again, even though they really never learned this when they were orphaned? And the answer seems to be yes. but not very well. I mean, not with the kind of skills that this group had developed and observed for decades prior to this hit. I've watched them, in fact, as recently as two days ago up in Sheep Country. They seem to be figuring out that there's something to eat up there, and so they're getting up there and they're chasing sheep around and catching a few now and then, but with nowhere near the skill that the group did prior to the loss of all the experience in 2005. But they are at least trying to do it, and they seem to have the idea how to go about doing it, and it's going to take a while before the group develops all the neat pursuit and capture strategies and killing strategies that I had observed for previous decades. But they do seem to know that that's where they got to go now, since the hares are pretty well disappearing. They've got to go back up into sheep country and figure out how to kill sheep, and they're trying and meeting with some degree of success.
From the perspective of research, this is rich. You'll be able to watch what happens.
Well, exactly, and I understand how important of an opportunity this is. Now, let me emphasize that these wolves now are 4, 5, 6 years old. They have a lot more savvy than they would have had a few years ago had they been forced to start figuring out on their own how to hunt moose and sheep. They at least have some idea how to go about it now. They're just several years older and in general are a little more savvy. So that certainly helps. But I also want to emphasize that while they're up there chasing these sheep around in the high mountains and also taking on moose, meeting with some success, it's all pretty awkward compared to the smooth way that this group was able to do these kind of things and hunt these ways prior to the loss of all this experience. All the finesse and the knowledge of the country, individual mountains and all, that's going to take a while for that to come back.
Right.
And maybe some of it, some of the sophisticated strategies they use, may never come back. I mean, there's not much doubt they're going to be able to hunt. It's just that the group had accrued decades of experience and developed some really sophisticated strategies, and that stuff is lost. Some of it will be redeveloped, some new strategies, but, you know, it's like a culture that has just been set back, and it's just a shame. It's just the idea of taking a really sophisticated society and just knocking it way back in time again. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense, and it's just sad from many standpoints.
Well, that raises another aspect of this. Part of the story of that particular hit back in 2005 was a very sad story about what's happening at the borders of Denali National Park, which, of course, in many respects, it's a wolf sanctuary, but again, it's actually not. There's some really unfair systems and loopholes being created that are not serving the wolves at all.
Well, the biggest problem is in one area in particular along the northeast boundary of Denali National Park. Way back as early as my 817-page PhD dissertation, this area was identified as the most important ungulate, that it means moose, caribou, and sheep, wintering area for the entire Denali wildlife ecosystem. And in that area, the map boundaries have absolutely nothing whatsoever, no relevance whatsoever to the ecological boundaries. They cut right straight across this wintering area. And these are traditional areas that moose and caribou and sheep from the park go to regularly, and of course wolves from many areas go there at times to hunt them. As a result, well, trappers just line right up there on the map boundaries, which make no sense whatsoever. And so these wolves are continuing to be hit. And this winter has been the worst one in a long time. I mean, the Tokwak group, as we speak, has lost about 6 or 8 members so far, and some of them we're now seeing, as of a couple of days ago, coming back into the park wearing snares with their necks halfway cut through. It's hideous. It's terrible. We know they're being trapped and snared. There's at least 4 or 5 other groups that have been wiped out in that area this winter alone. Some of the groups that use that area at times in the winter come from as far as 60, 70, 80 miles away, way out in central areas of the park. It's such an area of such traditional importance that certain groups that don't have the rich prey resources that Tokwak has have to migrate there to meet their winter food needs, and they're being hit as well.
Well, the aspect of this that is so totally unrealistic is the fact that, as you say, there's a line. And for people who aren't familiar with what's going on there's a line. And now with the GPS, that line can be a foot on this side or a foot on this side, and any wolf that steps 10 feet beyond that line becomes fair game to be taken in any number of different ways.
Trappers are lining right up on that line. They know exactly where it is. They're taking advantage of it. There's at least 3 or 4 trap lines out there this winter. And, you know, it's not something that we just discovered. This area has been well known as the most important wintering area for Denali wildlife. You know, it's been known for decades and published. And, you know, every time I try to get protection in that area, most shocking of all is the resistance I get comes primarily from other biologists, primarily from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. They just totally poo-poo the effort and say, well, you know, these wolves will repopulate the area, you know, no big deal, you know. The primary opposition is coming from other biologists. That's what's most disgraceful.
One of the stories is that there's literally a snowmobile line that is X number of feet outside of that GPS-identified boundary where there's a line of traps, so that some trapper is literally setting traps and snares. You'll tell me more about that. Literally right outside the border. How long does that trap line run?
Well, there's actually at least three trap lines this winter that are doing exactly what you just described, right along one section of the boundary. This is there's a couple of maps in some of the blogs that I wrote earlier this winter in the blog section of my website showing the area we're talking about. But there's a stretch of the Northeast Park boundary that maybe runs, so I don't know, 11, 12 miles, and three trap lines along that section of the boundary alone.
They literally set bait.
Oh yeah,
for these animals.
Yeah, that's how they do it. This is one of the most hideous things of all. They use traps and snares, but snares are particularly common, and they'll put a bait there, some old moose guts or something frozen, you know, in a plastic bag, you know, a couple of feet diameter or so, and throw it out there, and they'll lace the area of the brush with as many as I've seen 50, 60 snares in one area. Maybe 20, 30 snares is more common, but the wolves come into these areas, you know, they smell the baits, and they come into those areas, and they get snagged in all kinds of hideous ways, by the legs, by the midsection around the neck, by these snares, and, you know, when they work properly, the wolf dies pretty quick, but they don't work properly a lot. I mean, right now, I mean, at Saturday, and I'm going to unfortunately have to put photographs of these up on my website because I want people to see how bad it is, but, you know, as recently as Saturday, I photographed a wolf that's been running around now with a snare that it obviously pulled loose out of, broke the snare or the anchor cable, but the snare is cut about halfway through his neck. The pictures I took of it just recently, I mean, its whole front part of its neck and its face is swollen up like a balloon because the snare is so tight on it.
What's very difficult is the fact that this is becoming politicized somehow. I don't quite understand this, but it almost, as you say, it's getting worse instead of better. And that's exactly what we don't need. It's almost as if there's a war that's being waged between the pro-wolf hunting advocates, which also appears to be moving into the state levels of decision-making in the Fish and Wildlife and others, and those people who say, excuse me, this is inappropriate. The hunting season for wolves has just gone goofy in Alaska. Why don't you talk about some of those details?
Let me put it this way. You can do anything you want to a wolf pretty much in Alaska, and there's some law somewhere that'll make it legal.
Right.
I mean, for example, and a lot of it is really deceptive and intentionally so. For example, anybody who's got an Alaska driver's license, and you can get one of those after about 30 days, go to the nearest department store, sporting goods store, any place you want, and buy a trapping license for $15. That trapping license enables you to kill wolves with no limit whatsoever, starting in most areas in either October or November, right through to the end of April, even though the pelts are no good at all after mid to late March because of rubbing and, you know, the warm weather and all that. You can kill them without limit. You don't even have to use a trap or a snare with that trapping, so-called trapping license. You can just shoot them. That's legal with a trapping license.
This, to me, paints an image of literally decimating areas with no constraints whatsoever.
Well, that's just the beginning here. I haven't even scratched the surface yet here. Now, you can also kill wolves with a hunting license. Now, with a hunting license, you can start killing wolves on August 10th. In Alaska, the areas I work in, and most other areas of Alaska, wolves raise their pups. The pups are born in a den in early to mid-May, and they're attended at a den or a rendezvous site, usually through the end of September into October. They're totally dependent on the adults. They can't hunt. The adults leave them at a fixed location and bring food back to them on a regular basis.
These are little pups.
Right, exactly. Well, starting about halfway through that period, it's legal to kill these wolves or the wolves they depend on. You can, starting August 10th, even though these pups are still being provisioned at a den, you can shoot any wolf you can see. It doesn't matter, male, female, it doesn't matter at all. If you come across pups, you can shoot them. But, you shoot a wolf that you see out ranging around, and it's probably out hunting for pups back at a den. And so you shoot that wolf, and the pups back at the den just wait there forever, and the adults never come back, and they just starve to death slowly. Even worse than that, in the spring, as I said, pups are born in early to mid-May. Well, the hunting season legally extends in many areas, including right outside Denali National Park, until the end of May. So that means that little pups are born in the den. They don't even come out of the den for the first time until the first few days of June, usually. Well, an adult or a set of adults or a number of adults may be out hunting. Well, of course, the pups are still nursing in the den, but every once in a while, the mother has to go out and find something to eat herself, and maybe her mate and others that are with her are doing the same, but a hunter can come across those wolves before the end of May and shoot them. And, of course, if they shoot the mother, those little pups inside the den are just going to die a very slow death. The mother will never come back. They won't have anybody to keep warm. They won't have anybody to nurse from. And they just die a slow death inside the den. That's all legal.
You know, after we've talked about their intelligence, their wisdom, the information that they store in their heads from years and years of hunting, and they can live for 10 and 15 and longer years, and the fact that they, this is literally a family. The idea that they should be treated as if they're just some vermin,
and
taken out for people like myself and you and millions of other people, and quite honestly, most of the people in Alaska, as far as I can tell, they're just really opposed to that. It's troublesome.
It is absolutely appalling, and I want to emphasize, and this isn't easy for me to say, but it's fellow professionals that are really ultimately behind these policies and the ones who tell the policymakers it's okay to do this and so forth. And I'm speaking specifically of a biologist from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I have nothing but contempt for the people at the biologists within the department who advocate and give their approval to those kind of policies. They would not occur if the biologists at the state level, who the state policymakers take their guidance from, told them otherwise. If they said, no, this isn't right, we can't do this, it's not a good idea, biologically it doesn't make sense, it wouldn't happen. But it happens because they either say it's fine, there's no problem doing this, and the details are on my website if anybody wants to read it.
You know, there's another aspect to this, too. They're actually now encouraging helicopter killing of specific wolves for the purpose of supposedly helping caribou populations. To me, it's almost like a campaign to change public opinion about wolves and how they're affecting populations of animals, which is not based on science.
Well, there's a lot of aerial hunting already going on that's approved by the Policymaking Board of Game, again, with the recommendations from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Why? And, but, I mean, what's the basis for their...
Well, you know, it's a complex story, and again, there's just tons of detailed technical as well as other stuff on my website you can read, but the short of it is that policymakers and hunters in Alaska have been led to believe, again, primarily from publications and reports from biologists, that basically any time you kill wolves, it's going to mean more moose and caribou for them to hunt. Well, that just isn't true. So even if it were, never does anybody consider any of the costs of killing wolves. Just like killing wolves is totally cost-free. There's no scientific, there's no biological cost, there's no ethical cost. It's just like, hey, there's just no cost at all, so we can make any mistake we want. Even if we think we're erring, it doesn't matter because there's no cost to killing these wolves. They're essentially equated to rats at a dump, literally. In fact, one policymaking member of the Board of Game even referred to them that way here recently at the last Board of Game meeting, as rats, basically. It's frustrating, to say the least, and sad and revolting. And
I oftentimes look at these truths and I say, you know, if you had to buy a wolf, if wolves are considered, as they are by many people, extraordinary creatures, which they are, they're beautiful, they're intelligent, they're strong, they're so filled with power, and they're magical creatures. If you had to buy one, what is a wolf worth? You know, if you looked at all of those factors, you said, gosh, what is a wolf worth? I mean, it'd be probably $1,000 or more, just kind of at a value. And unfortunately, they're being treated as if, as you say, they're literally worth nothing. That is inconceivable to me.
I'll tell you what really, to me, is just a tremendous irony. You know, here we are, we're an intelligent species, and we seem to have a need to know that we're not alone in terms of other, you know, that there's other intelligent life. And I think you can see that in the way we're sending probes to the depths of the universe right now. We seem to have this desire to know that there's other intelligent life out there to discover it. I mean, I think it's because we want to know we're not alone. And isn't it ironic that at the same time we're spending all this effort sending these probes to the far reaches, that we're trashing intelligent life right in our midst, non-human, you know, other non-human intelligent life right in our midst, the wolves, whales, dolphins, chimpanzees, I mean, these relative handful of species that are clearly head and shoulders above most others in their levels of sentience and overall intelligence and whatnot and cognition. And that certainly is the case with wolves. I mean, how ironic is that?
I couldn't agree with you more. So that's a wonderful way of putting that.
And who are we hurting the most? We're hurting ourselves. This is diminishing our own existence. I mean, these wolves, for example, that I interact with, I mean, they enliven the northern mountains and the forest and the tundra like no other creature. I mean, there are a lot of intelligent things out there, and I appreciate them all and am enthralled by them all and consider them all equally important. But the wolves just kind of enliven the country more than anything. And I mean, it just makes the place more worth living in, you know, when you have other intelligent life out there like that.
I've often felt that there's a difference between people who get it and people who don't, and sometimes it's impossible to reach those who don't, that life is a wonder, and that these creatures have an extraordinary value. And to those that don't get that, I don't know how we're going to fix that.
Well, and it's particularly, as I say, frustrating to me to see so many other biologists in the business that have absolutely no sense of wonder. I think that's the most important ingredient of all to be a good scientist and a good biologist, is to have that childlike sense of wonder. And yet I watch biologists in the Alaska Department of Fish and Game who basically are the ones who draw up all these plans for the policymakers to kill all these wolves, and it's just like I'm looking at robots. They have no sense of wonder, no appreciation of any of this beauty or fascination. Of course, a lot of it's because they just don't get out there and watch these critters much. But it really frustrates me to see this coming from my own profession. Disgusts me is a better way to describe it.
We're talking with Dr. Gordon Haber, who has been studying the Toklat wolves for 41 years now. You can follow a lot of his work, literally, daily and weekly, and you should. It's a fascinating story, what's happening right now to the remnants, for example, of that original Toklat wolf family. Why don't you give us some information on best ways for people to, first of all, find out what you're doing, but also to help support your work?
First of all, let me just emphasize that the last entry I put up on that website was March 15th, just because I've been so busy in the field. But over the next week or two, I expect to put a whole bunch of new stuff up there, and particularly a lot of photographs and so forth. So just keep an eye on that. And as far as how my work is supported, I'm very lucky. There's a group back east called Friends of Animals, led by a very capable president, and they provide my funding with no strings attached. I work independently, and you know, I don't have to worry about raising money, but if anybody is interested in my work and thinks it's worthwhile and wants to support it, just take a look at the last page of my website called Contribute, and that'll give you details as to how you, if you want to, how you can help to keep this research going. And frankly, the best way is to go straight to the Friends of Animals website and contribute there, because they provide my needs, and that frees me of having to worry about raising funds. So that'd be the best thing.
Well, it's April 1st, and it's spring in the country. What happens this time of the year as you go out now and follow the wolves? Give us what you're looking forward to.
Well, we just finished the most intense period of the year, the courtship and mating period, in late February and March, and now it's just a matter of watching the wolves come through the rest of the winter until they start producing their new young in early to mid-May. I look at things in terms of biological years, which basically extend from May to the end of April, and so now I just kind of follow them the rest of the biological year to see what's left when they produce their new young at the beginning of the next biological year in May.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and you've dedicated primarily your entire life to this quest, but what a fascinating life it's been, I'm sure.
I certainly enjoyed it, and I'm doing it because it really is stimulating, and it can be very depressing with all the human killing that's going on. You can imagine what it's like to watch these animals that I get to know very well and suddenly see them ending up in snares. And
you know, I really need to ask you, what could listeners do? There's so many challenges before us these days, but for those people who have the time and the inclination, what could they do?
Well, right now, in terms of protection for Denali wolves, the policymaking board of game has absolutely refused to consider the issue, at least not until after 2010. So the only possibility right now of getting some sort of closure against hunting and trapping in the areas where the problems are occurring just outside the boundary is through the guy who runs the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. The title is Commissioner of Fish and Game. And if you go to my website, the March 1st blog entry, the bottom section of that entry is titled What to Do. And you read that, and down toward the bottom of that section, I have the names and phone numbers and email addresses of the top three managers of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, who are also biologists, the Commissioner of Fish and Game, the Deputy Commissioner for Wildlife, and the Director of the Division of Wildlife, and then also the Governor of Alaska. Send emails and call those numbers and tell them you want protection for the Denali wolves in the areas indicated on my website. That would be along the Northeast Park boundary. That's where most of the problems are occurring. And I guess that would be the most effective thing for now.
It makes me think about the Sea Shepherd and Captain Watson, who's puts himself between the illegal Japanese whaling research vessels in the Arctic and his own ship, the Steve Irwin. The unfortunate thing is that that type of action can be so dangerous, particularly with people with guns and different things. I'm not suggesting people do that, but I do feel a frustration in the fact that it seems as if those people who are willing to really be aggressive and in essence violent pretty much push us out of the way. And there's just an injustice there. That's all I can say. There's just a terrific injustice that hopefully someday we'll be able to change in this world.
Well, I hope it happens sooner than later, especially with regard to a group like this, the Toklat wolves that have been around for 41 years. What a shame it would be to lose them. I mean, something that's been around so long, it's already a big shame to see the hits they're taking and how that's screwing up the chances to learn from them and all the other fascinating things that are possible.
As I look at your website and I see them catching bunny rabbits, as opposed to some of the grand images that you have from some of their earlier hunts, it's quite a story.
Well, even the way they adapted to the latter decline of the snowshoe hares is pretty fast. Shows a lot of intelligence how they adjusted their hare hunting techniques.
Yes.
People can see that if they go to that particular blog entry, which is, I think it's February 3rd, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, Dr. Gordon Haber, I want to say thank you so much for all that you do and for taking all this time to talk about this. I personally could talk to you for probably days, and maybe someday I'll have a chance to do that. I hope to get up there, and that would be fascinating. Thank you so much for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News.
And you're quite welcome.
For more information, go to today's show page where you'll find links to the websites which Dr. Haber mentions. Please, pick up your pen, blast out some emails, call, do what you can. It is, at this time, our only defense. And join us next week for the most important 15 minutes on Earth, the Weekly Earth Summit. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Tuesday or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.